He looks tense. It seems his gout is troubling him. But he is attentive to her, murmuring pleasantries to which he gets no response. Her expression is adjusted to a careful blankness. The king has a Wingfield lady on his arm, face up-tilted, chattering. He is taking no notice of her at all. He looks large, broad, benign. His regal glance scans the crowd. It alights on him. The king smiles. As he leaves the church, Henry puts on his hat. It is a big hat, a new hat. And in that hat there is a feather.
Part 5, Chapter 1, Anna Regina, 1533. The two children sit on a bench in the hall of Austin Friars. They are so small that their legs stick straight out in front of them, and as they are still in smocks, one cannot tell their sex. Under their caps, their dimpled faces beam. That they look so fat and contented is a credit to the young woman, Helen Barr, who now unwinds the thread of her tale. Daughter of a bankrupt small merchant out of Essex, wife of one Matthew Barr, who beat her and deserted her. "Leaving me," she says, indicating, "with that one in my belly." The neighbours are always coming at him with parish problems, unsafe cellar doors, a noisome goose house, a husband and wife who shout and bang pans all night, so the next house can't get to sleep. He tries not to fret if these things cut into his time, and he minds Helen less than a goose house. Mentally, he takes her out of cheap shrunken wool and redresses her in some figured velvet he saw yesterday, 6 shillings the yard. Her hands, he sees, are skinned and swollen from rough work. He supplies kid gloves.
"Though when I say he deserted me, it may be that he is dead. He was a great drinker and a brawler. A man who knew him told me he came off worst in a fight, and I should seek him at the bottom of the river. But someone else saw him on the quays at Tilbury with a travelling bag. So which am I, wife or widow?"
"I will look into it, though I think you would rather I didn't find him. How have you lived?"
"When he went first, I was stitching for a sailmaker. Since I came up to London to search, I've been hiring out by the day. I've been in the laundry at a convent near Paul's, helping at the yearly wash of their bed linen. They find me a good worker. They say they will give me a pallet in the attics, but they won't take the children."
Another instance of the church's charity. He runs up against them all the time. "We cannot have you a slave to a set of hypocrite women. You must come here. I am sure you will be useful. The house is filling up all the time, and I am building, as you see." She must be a good girl, he thinks, to turn her back on making a living in the obvious way. If she walked along the street, she wouldn't be short of offers. "They tell me you would like to learn to read, so you can read the gospel."
"Some women I met took me to what they call a night school. It was in a cellar at Broadgate. Before that, I knew Noah, the three kings, and Father Abraham, but St. Paul I'd never heard of. At home on our farm, we had pucks who used to turn the milk and blow up thunderstorms, but I'm told they're not Christians. I wish we had stayed farming for all that. My father was no hand at town life."
Her eyes, anxious, follow the children. They've launched themselves off the bench and toddled across the flagstones to see the picture that's growing on the wall, and their every step causes her to hold her breath. The workman is a German, a young boy Hans recommended for a simple job, and he turns around, he speaks no English, to explain to the children what he's doing. A rose, three lions, see them jump, two blackbirds.
"Red!"
the elder child cries.
"She knows colours," Helen says, pink with pride. "She's also beginning on 1, 2, 3.
The space where the arms of Woolsey used to be is being repainted, with his own newly granted arms. Asia, on a fess between three lions rampant, or a rose gules, barbed vair, between two Cornish choughs proper.
"You see, Helen," he says, "those blackbirds were Woolsey's emblem." He laughs. "There are people who hoped they would never see them again."
"There are other people of our sort who do not understand it."
"You mean night school people?"
"They say, how can a man who loves the gospel have loved such a man as that?"
"I never liked his haughty manners, you know,
and his processions every day, the state he kept. And yet there was never a man more active in the service of England since England began. And also, he says sadly, when you came into his confidence, he was a man of such grace and ease. Helen, can you come here today? He's thinking of those nuns and the yearly wash of their bed linen. He's imagining the cardinal's appalled face. Laundry women followed his train as whores follow an army, hot from their hour-by-hour exertions. At York Place, he had a bath made, deep enough for a man to stand up in it, the room heated by a stove, such as you find in the Low Countries. And many a time he had negotiated business with the cardinal's bobbing, boiled-looking head. Henry has taken it over now, and splashes about in it with favoured gentlemen, who submit to being ducked under the water and half-drowned by their lord, if his mood takes him that way. The painter offers the brush to the elder child. Helen glows. "Careful, darling," she says. A blob of blue is applied. "You are a little adept," the painter says. "Gefällt es Ihnen, Herr Cromwell? Sind Sie stolz darauf?" He says to Helen, he asks if I am pleased and proud. She says, if you are not, your friends will be proud for you. I'm also translating, he thinks, if not language to language, then person to person. Anne to Henry, Henry to Anne. Those days when he wants soothing, and she is as prickly as a holly bush. Those times, they do occur, when his gaze strays after another woman, and she follows it, and storms off to her own apartments. He, Cromwell, goes about like some public poet, carrying assurances of desire each to each. 'Tis hardly 3 o'clock, and already the room is half dark. He picks up the younger child, who flops against his shoulder and falls asleep, with the speed at which someone pushed falls off a wall. "Helen," he says, "this household is full of pert young men, and they will all put themselves forward in teaching you to read, bringing you presents and trying to sweeten your days. Do learn and take the presents, and be happy here with us. But if anyone is too forward, you must tell me, or tell Ralph Sadler. He is the boy with the little red beard, though I should not say boy. It will be 20 years soon since he brought Ralph in from his father's house. A lowering dark day like this, rain bucketing from the heavens, the child slumped against his shoulder as he carried him into his hall at Fenchurch Street. The storms had kept them in Calais for 10 days. Ships out of Boulogne were wrecked, Antwerp flooded, much of the countryside put under water. He would like to get messages to his friends, inquiring after their lives and property, but the roads are impassable. Calais itself is a floating island upon which a happy monarch reigns. He goes to the king's lodgings to ask for an audience. A business doesn't stop in bad weather. But he is told, "The king cannot see you this morning. He and Lady Anne are composing some music for the harp." Ralph catches his eye and they walk away. "Let us hope in time they have a little song to show for it." Thomas Wyatt and Henry Norris get drunk together in a low tavern. They swear eternal friendship, but their followers have a fight in the inn yard and roll each other in mud. He never sets eyes on Mary Boleyn. Presumably, she and Stafford have found some bolt hole where they can compose together. By candlelight at noon, Lord Berners shows him his library, limping energetically from desk to desk, handling with care the old folios from which he has made his scholarly translations. Here is a romance of King Arthur. "When I started reading it, I almost gave up the project. It was clear to me it was too fantastical to be true. But little by little, as I read, you know, it appeared to me that there was a moral in this tale." He does not say what it is. "And here is Froissart done into English, which His Majesty himself bade me undertake. I could not do other, for he had just lent me £500. Would you like to see my translations from the Italian? They are private ones. I have not sent them to the printer." He spends an afternoon with the manuscripts, and they discuss them at supper. Lord Berners holds a position, Chancellor of the Exchequer, which Henry has given him for life. But because he is not in London, and attending to it, it does not bring him in much money, or the influence it should.
I know you are a good man for business. Might you in confidence look over my accounts? They're not what you'd call in order.
Lord Berners leaves him alone with the dog's breakfast that he calls his ledgers. An hour passes. The wind whistles across the rooftops. The candle flames tremble. Hail batters the glass. He hears the scrape of his host's bad foot. An anxious face peers around the door.
What joy?
All he can find is money owing. This is what you get for devoting yourself to scholarship and serving the king across the sea, when you could be at court with sharp teeth and eyes and elbows ready to seize your advantage. I wish you'd called on me earlier. There are always things that can be done.
Ah, but who knew you, Master Cromwell? The old man says. One exchanged letters, yes. Wolsey's business, king's business. But I never knew you. It did not seem at all likely I should know you until now.
On the day they are finally ready to embark, the boy from the alchemist's inn turns up.
You at last. What have you got for me?
The boy displays his empty hands and launches into English of a sort.
Indeed, those magi have returned to Paris.
Then I am disappointed.
You are hard to find, monsieur. I go to the place where le roi Henri and the grand putain are lodged. Je cherche milord Cromwell. And the persons there laughed at me and beat me.
That is because I am not a milord.
In that case, I do not know what a milord in your country looks like.
He offers the boy a coin for his efforts, and another for the beating, but he shakes his head.
I sought to take service with you, monsieur. I have made up my mind to go travelling.
Your name is?
Christophe.
You have a family name?
Saint Ferrien.
You have parents? A shrug. Your age?
What age would you say?
I know you can read. Can you fight?
There is much fighting chez vous.
Christophe has his own squat build. He needs feeding up, but a year or two from now he will be hard to knock over. He puts him at 15, no more. You are in trouble with the law?
In France, he says, disparagingly,
as one might say, in far Cathay.
You are a thief?
The boy makes a jabbing motion, invisible knife in his fist.
You left someone dead.
He didn't look well.
He grins.
You're sure you want Christophe your name? You can change it now, but not later.
You understand me, monsieur?
Christ, of course I do. You could be my son.
Then he looks at him closely, to make sure that he isn't. That he isn't one of these brawling children the cardinal spoke of, whom he's left by the Thames, and not impossibly by other rivers, in other climes. But Christophe's eyes are a wide, untroubled blue.
You are not afraid of the sea voyage? He asks. In my house in London there are many French speakers. You'll soon be one of us.
Now at Austin Friars, Christophe pursues him with questions. Those magi, what is it they have? Is it a cart of buried treasure? Is it... He flaps his arms. The instructions for one to make a flying machine. Is it a machine to fare great explosions, or a military dragon, breathes out fire? He says, have you ever heard of Cicero?
No, but I am prepared to hear of him. Till today I have never heard of Bishop Gardiner. Indeed, you have stole his strawberry beds, and give them to the king's mistress, and now he intends...
The boy breaks off. And again gives his impression of a military dragon.
To ruin you utterly and pursue you unto death.
And well beyond, if I know my man.
There have been worse accounts of his situation. He wants to say, she is not a mistress, not any more. But the secret, though it must soon be an open secret, is not his to tell. 25th of January, 1533. Dawn. The chapel at Whitehall. His friend Roland Lee as priest, Anne and Henry take their vows, confirm the contract they made in Calais. Almost in secret, with no celebration, just a huddle of witnesses, the married pair both speechless, except for the small admissions of intent, forced out of them by the ceremony. Henry Norris is pale and sober. Was it kind to make him witness it twice over, Anne being given to another man? William Brereton is a witness, as he is in attendance in the King's Privy Chamber.
"Are you truly here?" he asks him. "Or are you somewhere else? You gentlemen tell me you can bilocate like great saints."
Brereton glares.
"You've been writing letters up to Chester. The King's business, how not?"
They must do this in a mutter, as Roland joins the hands of bride and groom.
"I'll tell you just once, keep away from my family's affairs, or you'll come off worse, Master Cromwell, than you can imagine."
Anne is attended by only one lady, her sister. As they leave, the King, towing his wife, hand on her upper arm, towards a little harp music, Mary turns and gives him a sumptuous smile. She holds up her hand, thumb and finger, an inch apart. She had always said, "I will be the first to know. It will be me who lets out her bodices." He calls William Brereton back, politely. He says, "You have made a mistake in threatening me." He goes back to his office in Westminster. He wonders, does the King know yet? Probably not. He sits down to his drafting. They bring in candles. He sees the shadow of his own hand moving across the paper, his own unconcealable fist unmasked by velvet glove. He wants nothing between himself and the weave of the paper, the black running line of ink. So he takes off his rings, Wolsey's turquoise and Francis's ruby. At New Year, the King slid it from his own finger and gave it back to him, in the setting the Calais goldsmith had made, and said, as rulers do, in a rush of confidence, "Now that will be a sign between us, Cromwell. Send a paper with this, and I shall know it comes from your hand, even if you lack your seal." A confidant of Henry's, who was standing by, it was Nicholas Carew, had remarked, "His Majesty's ring fits you without adjustment." He said, "So it does." He hesitates, his quill hovering. He writes, "This realm of England is an empire. This realm of England is an empire, and so has been accepted in the world, governed by one supreme head and king." At 11 o'clock, when the day has brightened as much as it will, he eats dinner with Cranmer in his lodging at Cannon Row, where he is living till his new dignity is conferred, and he can move into Lambeth Palace. He has been practising his new signature, Thomas Elect of Canterbury. Soon he will dine in state, but today, like a threadbare scholar, he shoves his papers aside while some table linen is laid, and they bring in a salt fish, over which he signs a grace. "That won't improve it," he says. "Who's cooking for you? I'll send someone over."
"So, is the marriage made?"
It is like Cranmer to wait to be told, to work 6 hours in silent patience, head down over his books.
"Yes. Roland was up to his office. He didn't wed her to Norris, or the King to her sister."
He shakes out his napkin.
"I know a thing, but you must coax it from me."
He's hoping that Cranmer, by way of coaxing, will impart the secret he promised in his letter, the secret written down the side of the page. But it must have been some minor indiscretion, now forgotten. And because Canterbury Elect is occupied in poking uncertainly at scales and skin, he says,
"She, Anne, she's already having a child."
Cranmer glances up.
"If you tell it in that tone, people will think you take the credit yourself."
"Are you not astonished? Are you not pleased?"
"I wonder what fish this purports to be," Cranmer says with mild interest. "Naturally, I'm delighted. But I knew it, you see, because this marriage is clean. Why would not God bless it with offspring and with an heir?"
"Of course, with an heir. Look."
He takes out the papers he has been working on. Cranmer washes his fishy fingers and hunches towards the candle flame.
"So, after Easter," he says, reading, "it will be against the law and the King's prerogative to make an appeal in any matter to the Pope. So there is Catherine's suit dead and buried, and I, Canterbury, can decide the King's cause in our own courts. Well, this has been long enough coming."
He laughs.
"You were long enough coming."
Cranmer was in Mantua when he heard of the honour the King intended for him.
He began his journey circuitously. Stephen Vaughan met him at Lyon, and hustled him over the winter roads and through the snowdrifts of Picardy to the boat. "Why did you delay? Doesn't every boy want to be an archbishop? Though not me, if I think back. What I wanted was my own bear." Cranmer looks at him, his expression speculative. "I'm sure that could be arranged for you." Gregory has asked him, "How will we know when Dr. Cranmer is making a joke?" He has told him, "You won't. They are as rare as apple blossom in January." And now, for some weeks, he will be half fearful that a bear will turn up at his door. As they part that day, Cranmer glances up from the table and says, "Of course, I don't officially know." "About the child?" "About the marriage. As I am to be judge in the matter of the king's old marriage, it would not be proper for me to hear that his new one has already taken place."
"Right," he says.
What Roland gets up to in the early hours of the morning is a matter for himself alone. He leaves Cranmer, with head bowed over the remains of their meal, as if studying to reassemble the fish. As our severance from the Vatican is not yet complete, we cannot have a new archbishop unless the Pope appoints him. Delegates in Rome are empowered to say anything, promise anything, pro tem, to get Clement to agree. The king says aghast, "Do you know how much the papal bulls cost for Canterbury, and that I shall have to pay for them? And do you know how much it costs to install him?" He adds, "It must be done properly, of course. Nothing omitted, nothing scantered."
"It will be the last money your majesty sends to Rome, if it rests with me."
"And do you know," the king says, as if he's discovered something astonishing, "that Cranmer has not a penny of his own? He can contribute nothing." He borrows the money, on the crown's behalf, from a rich Genovese he knows called Salvago. To persuade him into the loan, he sends around to his house an engraving which he knows Sebastian covets. It shows a young man standing in a garden, his eyes turned upwards to an empty window, at which it is to be hoped very soon a lady will appear. A scent hangs already in the air, and birds on the boughs look inquiringly into the vacancy, ready to sing. In his two hands the young man holds a book. It is a book shaped like a heart. Cranmer sits on committees every day, in back rooms at Westminster. He's writing a paper for the king, to show that even if his brother's marriage to Catherine was not consummated, it does not affect the case for the annulment, for certainly they intended to be married, and that intention creates affinity. Also, in the nights they spent together, it must have been their intention to make children, even if they did not go about it the right way. In order not to make a liar out of Henry or Catherine, one or the other, the committee men think up circumstances in which the match may have been partly consummated, or somewhat consummated, and to do this, they have to imagine every disaster and shame that can occur between a man and a woman alone in a room in the dark. "Do you like the work?" he inquires, looking at their hunched and dusty persons. He judges them to have the experience they need. Cranmer, in his writing, keeps calling the Queen "the most serene Catherine," as if to separate her untroubled face, framed by a linen pillow, from the indignities being forced on her lower body, the boys fumbling and scrabbling, the pawing at her thighs. Meanwhile Anne, the hidden Queen of England, breaks free from her gentleman companions as she walks through a gallery at Whitehall. She laughs as she breaks into a trot, almost a skip, and they reach out to contain her, as if she is dangerous, but she flings their hands away from her, laughing. "Do you know, I have a great longing to eat apples. The king says it means I am having a baby, but I tell him no, no, it can't be that." She whirls around, around again. She flushes, tears bounce out of her eyes and seem to fly away from her like the waters of an unregulated fountain. Thomas Wyatt pushes through the crowd. "Anne." He snatches at her hands. He pulls her towards him. "Anne, hush, sweetheart, hush." She collapses into hiccuping sobs, folding herself against his shoulder. Wyatt holds her fast. His eyes travel around, as if he had found himself naked in the road, and is looking for some traveller to come along with a garment to cover his shame. Among the bystanders is Chapuis, The ambassador makes a rapid, purposeful exit, his little legs working, a sneer stamped on his face. So that's the news sped to the emperor. It would have been good if the old marriage were out, the new marriage in, confirmed to Europe before Anne's happy state were announced. But then, life is never perfect for the servant of a prince. As Thomas More used to say, we should not look to go to heaven on feather beds.